Every so often, there's a radio show or a whole series of interviews that actually changes how I see the world. And that's happened with the series we've been working on for the last couple of years on kinship with the more than human world. I'm Steve Paulson, and I want to welcome you to a new episode in our kinship series. This is going to be different from what you normally hear on To the Best of Our Knowledge. It's a single long interview, kind of wide-ranging conversation that we just don't have time for on the radio show. So before I introduce our guest, I want to say a little about why this idea of kinship has connected so profoundly with me. It's asking a really big question. What if we see all the animals and plants around us, the birds and dogs, the trees and flowers, not just as things to be admired or used, but as subjects in their own right? And what if we extend this perspective to other parts of the natural world that we don't usually think of as alive, like rocks and rivers? It means trying to imagine the personhood of a plant, or what it might be like to think like a mountain. There's something Robin Wall Kimmerer said in one of our earlier episodes that's really stayed with me. She's an ecologist and the author of Braiding Sweetgrass, and when Ann and I were sitting under a big tree in her yard in upstate New York, she said this: human people are only one kind of person. There are maple people. There are oriole people. There are cloud people. And that changes everything. So what changes when we don't think of human beings as the center of everything, or the most special, or the smartest? If you take this seriously, there are huge ethical implications. The natural world isn't just full of resources to be extracted or exploited. It means we need to be far more intentional about how we cut down trees and dig up minerals and kill animals. Now, I have to say, this way of thinking doesn't come easily to me. I found that it requires a leap of imagination, and it taps into age-old systems of knowledge that aren't part of my own cultural tradition, which is why I find it so exciting to talk with people who really inhabit this worldview. And that leads me to our guest today.
I'm Enrique Salmon, and I'm Rarámuri, and I'm a professor of American Indian Studies at California State University, East Bay.
Enrique talks about the indigenous knowledge that comes out of his own Rarámuri culture. It's rooted in the land, in the language, in stories that are passed down by the elders. He teaches a class on what he calls American Indian Science. And one of the ideas is that you cannot remove personal experience from explanations of how the world works, which cuts directly against the foundations of modern Western science. So a lot to talk about. Here is Enrique Salmon. Enrique, you have written about the idea of what's been called kincentricity. What does that word mean to you?
Kincentricity is just living with the idea or the concept, the worldview that everything around us is a relative and that we share breath with everything around us. And it's really focused on how the natural world, the plants, the animals, the rocks, the wind, the rain, the clouds, everything is a direct relative. And when I say the word breath in the Rarámuri, breath kind of translates into what other people might think of as soul or spirit, or people who study martial arts, you know, ki or chi energy, or if you're into Star Wars, the Force. You know, this is breath.
So this is, I mean, this idea of everything around you is a relative. I mean, this is so different than the normal way that we define who's a relative, you know, family or even human beings. You are extending this idea of relatedness much further into the non-human world.
Yes. Well, that's because I was raised in an indigenous culture, and like a lot of other indigenous cultures, where we owe our emergence into this world to elements from nature. Some cultures feel that certain animals help them get into this world. Some include plants. You know, the Hopi owe a lot of their emergence into this fourth world to Spider Woman and to a certain water plant that they climbed up along to get into this world from a hole in the ground. And for my people, we owe our emergence into this world to corn. We emerged from ears of corn. And so with that worldview, with that idea, it's hard not to think of everything around you as a direct relative. And it goes into our language as well, because in our language, the words that we use for a lot of plants and animals are the same words we use for our direct human relatives.
Really? What would be an example of that?
There's a tree that grows at the bottom of the Barranca del Cobre. It's a canyon down in Chihuahua, Mexico, that's deeper than the Grand Canyon. And it can be snowing up on the rim, and you get down to the bottom of the canyon and picking fresh oranges. There's a tree down there that you would know as Brazil wood, and we call it sitacame. That word is the same word we use for our female aunts, or aunt, as you might say in English.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So in other words, certain trees, certain plants are gendered? They might be identified as, say, either male or female?
All the plants have gender, and they also are identified by ethnicity. So,
how so with ethnicity?
One example is there's a cactus that's related to peyote. You know, we use peyote in ceremonies in our culture. There's a kind of peyote that certain powerful and knowledgeable shaman use. It's a little more touchy than regular peyote. And it's a male plant, but it's also an Apache. And when you think about it, for the longest time, for hundreds of years, we were in constant sort of conflict with Apaches coming down from Arizona, New Mexico, and raiding. And so it kind of makes sense that a plant that is dangerous and you have to really be careful around might be an Apache. And then corn, we call sunu, is a female. It's also a female rarámuri. There is another plant that was introduced back in the middle 1600s that came from Europe through the missionization by the Spaniards. And it's a male, what we call chavochi, which is a white person.
How did you learn all of this? Who taught you these words and this history in your culture?
Well, I grew up in our language. And so when one is immersed in one's language, you also are immersed in your culture's view of reality, your worldview. Because the language is our culture. And for everyone, you could say that about every culture around the world, the language is the culture. Because the way we think is directly related to how we form our thoughts in our languages. And so it was my family, a lot from my grandparents on my mother's side, and then being around people from my culture as well down in Chihuahua.
And did you grow up more in Chihuahua in Mexico or more in the U.S.?
More in the United States. We came here when I was really young. We went back and forth a few times, but we always were around for a ceremony. And then I spent a lot of time with my mother and my grandmother, learning a lot about plants and so on, being outside with my grandfather, sitting under his fruit trees and listening to stories and helping him in our cornfield and that sort of thing.
So would your grandmother or grandfather, would they kind of take you around and identify plants with you, tell stories about them?
No, it was never that structured. It's not like on Wednesday, my grandfather said, today we're going to learn about this.
Yeah.
it was always just, I guess you call it an experiential education, just being around it. And there's something I wrote about. I can't remember where I wrote about it once. It's something I called fig tree moments, because I remember my grandfather had this huge fig tree on the edge of his cornfield, and it would get hot out, and we'd sit under the fig tree and in the shade, and he would just whittle on a piece of wood and just tell me stuff sometimes. Or there were other times when I would be with my grandmother. She had this shack that my grandfather built, but it was built out of slats. The walls were slats, so you could actually see through it. It provided more shade than anything. And we would sit in there. She'd be grinding her herbs or drying plants or whatever. Those moments, she would tell me stuff about the plants. And she'd also talk about the plants and the animals and the insects when we were collecting plants as well.
It sounds like this whole, the culture that you're describing is also so connected to the landscape of the Rarámuri. It's sort of the two go together.
They're interconnected, yes. One of my favorite examples of that is when I'm teaching my American Indian Studies classes. I often tell my students that indigenous knowledge is local. It doesn't really transfer across ecosystems very well. And as a result, it's really, really hard to be a traditional Apache in Vermont because everything's just so different. And our language, they emerge from our landscapes. And so as a result, our cultures are emerging from specific landscapes. You know, our languages give voice to the land. We story the land. And so a traditional Apache out of the Chiricahua Mountains in Arizona just wouldn't know what to talk about in the Green Mountains of Vermont. This doesn't work.
And what's the landscape like in this part of Chihuahua, Mexico?
Well, it's like I said earlier, you know, our people live in and around this canyon that's three times bigger than the Grand Canyon, and it's 1,000 feet deeper. And the rim of the canyon is at between 6,000 to 8,000 feet. And then the mountains here, because it goes along the Sierra Madre, the spine of Mexico. And it gets up to 10,000 feet in elevation. And like I said before, it could be snowing up on the rim in January, but down at the bottom of the canyon, it's tropical. It's quite a magical landscape.
Yeah. I came across something that you said when you were sort of writing about landscape, that it's not just a matter of what you think about the landscape. There's another question. What does the landscape think of you?
Right.
Which is sort of this fascinating idea. How do you know what the landscape thinks of you?
Well, for people from my culture and for other indigenous people, it's not really that hard, especially if they're still living some sense of a traditional or ancestral lifestyle. And so collecting plants, farming, subsistence, fishing, all these things that native peoples still practice automatically put one in that sort of situation where you're constantly in contact with and listening to what the land is telling you. And so that's not hard. In my case, you know, like I was saying earlier, when I go fly fishing, that's a part of it. Or whenever I'm out hiking in the mountains or along the beach and constantly in contact and listening to what the land is saying, or even in my backyard where I'm gardening.
Can you tell me about fly fishing? I mean, where does that experience take you? How does that connect you to where you are when you're doing that?
It connects me directly to the whole watershed of whatever river I'm in. Because you're literally standing in the river and trying to think like a trout, in my case, up in the Sierra Nevadas here. And so thinking about the insects and how the water temperature is affecting them, the current, wind, even the clouds, whether or not it's shady, what time of day it is, all of these elements play a role in being directly connected to that watershed, that river, even that bend of the river. It's a form of concentrated mindfulness, to kind of borrow from some Buddhist teachings, of being fully aware of what's going on around you. And it's like we were saying, it's hard for modern people to do this, but it's not impossible. One of my favorite examples that I do this with my students, I teach a class called American Indian Science, which is a lot of what we're talking about here with kincentricity. And one of the semester-long assignments that I have my students do is to watch sunrises or sunsets. And what they have to do is once a week for the whole semester, at the same time of day, in the exact same spot, facing the same direction, they have to either watch a sunrise or a sunset. And then they take notes of what they experience for like 20 minutes. And the first 3 weeks or somewhere in there, you know, the students are in there. As I read their journals, they're kind of wondering, you know, why are we doing this? But then all of a sudden you start to read in their journals how they notice patterns. And they notice first that the sun actually moves throughout the year.
Yeah.
You know, that it's either further north or further south, depending on what semester we're doing this in. But then you start paying attention, you know, there's a deer that comes every morning, or there's certain insects hanging around in these plants. And then all of a sudden, by the end of the semester, they've practiced this form of concentrated mindfulness. They've listening to what the land is telling them.
Hmm. I'm so interested that you call your class American Indian Science. It's kind of different from most science classes you'd have in a college.
Well, you know, science is just a way of what we call Western science. It's just a way of explaining how the natural world operates and developing theses and theories and that sort of thing, hypotheses. And this all is resulting from observation and experimentation. Well, American Indians have been doing this in the case of North America, for thousands of years. Native peoples have been observing the natural world and, as a result, developing their interactions with the natural world from those observations. It's just another philosophy of science. And science is really a philosophy. In fact, if you look at the age of Newton and so on, they didn't refer to themselves as scientists. They called themselves natural philosophers.
Right. One of the conventions of most of modern science, Western science, is that you don't insert yourself into the story of what you're describing. I mean, there's sort of the sense of you're standing outside, you're trying to get an objective sense of what the nature of reality is. And it sounds like what you're saying is that personal experience is part of what American Indian Science is about. You can't remove the personal experience from that account of what is real.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense for a traditional Native person to remove themselves from that experience, because we are that experience, and that experience is us. One of my favorite examples of this was at the first Mesa on Hopi, at the Hopi Reservation. We were watching a woman's basket dance, and there was these cells of rain coming across the landscape over by the San Francisco peaks by Flagstaff. And an elder I was hanging out with saw me looking at it, and he goes, "Yeah, look at that rain. That rain is us. We are that rain. That land over there, that butte, that's us. We are that butte." And he did that several times, pointing out different elements of what was around us. And this is not unusual among indigenous people, that we are directly related to these things. And so this subjective approach to explaining the natural phenomena doesn't make sense to indigenous people, because those things are us as well.
Yeah. Well, you're also raising some profound questions about what personal identity is. If the rain is us, if we are the rain, that's rather different than sort of this basic idea in Western culture that the human being is an individual self. I mean, it sounds like you're saying that no, personal identity is something different. It's part of a larger collective.
Yeah. It's part of this huge community that goes beyond our tribe, our family, our culture, where the community includes the natural world as well. And for indigenous peoples, our identities are directly connected and emerge from that community. And it's an element of a culture that is a responsibility-based culture, which is why you hear A lot of people borrow that concept of the planes of thinking seven generations down the road, because you know, we have a responsibility for the seven generations down the road, but also we have responsibility for what is happening around us right now. This is so alien to a lot of American culture, because American culture is a rights-based culture where we have a right to do what we want to do as long as we're not, you know, breaking laws or hurting somebody else. But it lacks in responsibility of the people and the nature around us.
Going back to the sort of the question of what is science, how much can science reveal about reality, we're really talking about how we gain knowledge. Clearly, you're saying that the modern scientific lens is only one way to gain knowledge. And I'm wondering in the Ramuri culture, I mean, if there are other ways of passing on knowledge that are really important, that are really powerful in terms of ways to transmit the culture.
Now we're venturing into one of my favorite topics, and that's the power of story. Because for indigenous peoples, knowledge is transferred and reproduced through stories. And I'm not talking about the kind of story, you know, once upon a time, and then they all lived happily ever after. There's those kinds of stories. But, you know, it's expanding the notion of story, where story is like coyote stories. When an elder tells a young one or a group of young ones how pine trees got here or how we emerged into this world. But story is also ceremony, ritual. There's a whole story in a San Juan deer dancer in New Mexico holding a pine bow in their left hand. There's the story that's encoded, embedded in the songs that bird singers sing down in Southern California from the Kawiya culture. All of this is this larger category of story that is how what we know is reproduced and transferred within our cultures and sometimes cross cultures.
My guest is Enrique Salmon, an anthropologist and professor of American Indian Studies, and the author of the book Eating the Landscape. This conversation is part of our series on kinship with the more than human world. It sounds like a lot of these cultural traditions you've been describing, I mean, these native traditions, you can see parts of that in modern science, in ecological thinking. I'm thinking of something like the Gaia theory that talks about the earth as a living being. And I'm wondering if that science concept, does that resonate with you, or does that seem kind of more bookish and a little alien from your understanding of the earth as a living being?
It makes sense when I read things like the Gaia theory, or when I come across ecologists who borrow from indigenous worldviews, trying to connect it to their explanations for the natural world and processes. But I have a lot of problems when this happens, because most of the time they're taking indigenous knowledge out of context. And context is key to indigenous explanations of the natural world and what we might call American Indian science or even traditional ecological knowledge. Because remember earlier I talked about how all indigenous knowledge is local.
Right.
And so if the context is, say, you got some ecologists working in some watershed in the Colorado, in the Rocky Mountains, but they're borrowing from Karuk culture in Northern California, it's a misappropriation of the knowledge. And it's not going to apply cleanly enough, if that makes sense.
What would you suggest then for, say, a scientist who goes through university training, who does not come from that kind of cultural background? What can they do to honor and to really understand that context?
Well, you know, fortunately, there's still a lot of indigenous people around who know this kind of knowledge from different elements of nature. We're seeing more of this, but there's not enough of it, where Western scientists would help themselves if they included in their research teams indigenous peoples, and actually asking local native peoples to be a part of a research project and to include their interpretations of what is being studied.
Earlier, we talked about the idea of kincentricity, and I guess the sort of the parallel idea would be concentric ecology. You're talking about a different kind of ecology than most ecology that's taught at the university level.
Yeah. Yeah, kincentricity is more of what we were talking about before, worldview. It's a way of thinking. But concentric ecology is, I would think of as more as the art of living as part of a place. The land is a relative. And like you said earlier, where the land remembers everything about us, the people, in this sort of mutual experience that we have with each other. Because this art of living as part of a place is going to have a direct impact on the choices we make, the practices we have on a specific landscape. And so the land kind of becomes this center of moral behavior. The land reminds us of how to properly behave with it.
Give me an example of that. How does that translate into moral behavior?
Well, I remember picking berries, I can't remember which bush it was, with my grandmother. And she was telling me, you know, we should always, when we pick berries, get the berries from the central part of the bush, from the mid part of the bush, because we want to leave the berries in the lower part of the bushes for our little brothers and sisters, or small little brothers and sisters. And then we want to leave the berries in the upper part of the bush for our larger brothers and sisters. And so this is a moral way of gathering, for example.
Yeah. You've talked about human beings as a keystone species, which is a phrase that's usually used to describe certain animal species like wolves or beavers. And of course, these days, a lot of people think of humans as a blight on the natural world, not an integral part of a healthy ecology. How are we humans a keystone species?
We're a keystone species because we do things, whether good or bad, that have direct impact on plants and animals, watersheds, oceanscapes, and so on. We play a role in how the system operates. One of my favorite examples where this role is a positive one but has been taken away was years and years ago, sitting in a meeting with the Park Service and some Southern Paiute folks. And there was this one elder woman who was listening to these Park Service guys talking about the mesquite groves, and we got to let the mesquite groves just grow naturally. We're going to sort of cordon them off and not let anyone go on there. And then all of a sudden, this little 5 foot nothing woman stands up and kind of starts yelling at the Park Service guys and says, "You've let these mesquite groves become a mess. They're just a mess. And they're just overgrown. Nothing's happening there." And she said, "If you let us manage them like we've always managed them, then the plants and the animals will come back." And they were kind of dumbfounded because they thought they were doing a good thing. But what she was expressing was that because the Southern Paiute are such a part of that landscape, a keystone species, that when throughout the year they're permitted to sustainably prune the mesquites to collect the pods for food and so on, and to periodic burn the groves, what happens is that it clears out the competing bushes and herbaceous plants, and then it invites useful herbaceous plants to grow underneath the mesquite trees. And because they're not overgrown, animals, smaller animals and larger animals, can come and interact with the mesquite groves as well. So it's not just good for the people, it's good for all of that ecosystem. And as a result, the mesquite trees produce more edible pods.
I mean, that's sort of a fascinating take on a lot of modern ecological thinking and the whole notion of wilderness, which is usually thought of as, oh, this is the land that is untouched by humans. Maybe we need to redefine that idea.
We need to start touching the natural world again. I was given a talk once at Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado for Earth Day. And somewhere in my talk, I said something about wilderness. And afterwards, someone asked me, do you believe in wilderness? And I said, no. And there was this audible gasp in the room there because, you know, I was explaining how, well, when we set aside landscapes where, you know, all humans can do is leave behind footprints, that means we're not directly connecting with these landscapes, and the lands itself are getting lonely. The plants are lonely. The rocks are lonely for human interaction. They want us to interact in a sustainable way. And as human beings, we gain so much when we can sustainably interact with landscapes.
Should we just do away with the whole concept of wilderness or setting aside tracts of land that are basically untouched by humans?
That's a tough question because we're so overpopulated right now and people have never been taught proper behavior with the natural world. I think at this point we have to have landscapes that are set aside, that are protected, in other words. It's unfortunate, but until we as human beings learn to be mindful of our interactions with the natural world, then I think we have to do that.
Now, one thing that you said earlier that I found fascinating, I just want to explore that a little bit more, is you're talking about the breath that we share with everyone around us. I know that there's a Ramuri concept known as Iwigara, if I'm saying that right. Can you explain what that is?
Iwigara. It's this idea that everything moves in these overlapping cycles, and our breath, our soul, our spirit is constantly moving in these overlapping cycles. Iwigara is a longer version of the concept Iwi, which is a particular cycle of life and death. And it's also the same word we use to describe a certain species of butterflies that are constantly going through this cycle of life and death when they create cocoons and then emerge from the cocoons and so on. But then it's also directly connected to our own human cycles of life. And when we pass, we believe that our breath, our soul or spirit, whatever you want to call it, enters into certain species of butterflies, and that we visit favorite places and people and experiences that happen in our lifetimes. And afterwards, we move up into the Milky Way. Hmm. And if you ever want to count how many Ramuri there have ever been, just try to see if you can start counting the stars in the Milky Way on a clear night.
So when you talk about breath, I mean, this is a very kind of conceptual idea. I mean, really complicated. I mean, there's a whole philosophy and metaphysics here, but are you also talking about just kind of a physical level of breathing air in and exhaling, breathing air out?
Yeah, that's a part of it. And our breath is the same breath that bears breathe in and out, you know, when they're catching salmon up in Alaska, the same breath that Brazil wood trees breathe in and out as part of their process on the bottom of the Barranca del Cobre. It just, you know, never ends.
You know, when you were talking about this, I can't help but think about how resonant this is with the headlines in today's news, given all the horrible cases of African-American men who've died in police custody, who literally people who were saying, I can't breathe.
Right. Yeah, well, breathing is central to existence. And these police officers are breaking the cycle.
Yeah. For those of us who are not Ramuri, the vast majority of people who are listening to us right now, how can we relate to other plants and animals and the landscape as kin? If we're not born into that worldview, how can we cultivate that kind of kinship practice?
One of my favorite things is just ask people to grow a plant. To begin there, just grow a plant from a seed and watch it. Treat it like you would a pet, you know, like a pet dog or a pet cat. Give it a name and then practice feeding it. And what happens is that if you're really serious, then the individual engages in studying what that plant needs and what its cycles of existence are. What are your interactions with that plant, and how does it affect the plant? How does a plant affect you? And it could be a tomato plant, or who knows what, a cactus you put into the windowsill of your house or something like that, and just interact with it. And then over time, you don't even really realize it. You develop a relationship with that. And the next step is just making that mental, I guess, jump that this is a relative. I am, like Carl Sagan used to say, you know, I am, and this plant with me is stardust. We are the elements of the whole universe, and the whole universe is us. You know, we're not separated from that at all. Unfortunately, in modern cultures, Western cultures, we've become separated from those cycles.
Have you ever had any particular relationships, sort of powerful relationships with individual plants?
Probably one of the most powerful would be with chilies. And not just any chili, what you would call Anaheim chilies, those big, long, green chilies that are just a little bit spicy. Because I was raised with those, and I grow them in my backyard. Whenever I pick them, I immediately go and put them on the barbecue and roast them because I need to get that scent of roasted chilies, because all sort of familial and cultural and individual memories emerge from just smelling roasting chilies that take me back to hanging out with my grandmother and cooking green chili stew with her and just roasting chilies and peeling off the skin and eating them straight. And I can just go on and on about all these deep connections with just the smell of roasting green chilies.
Yeah. The other side of thinking of plants as kin is it's also the food that we eat and the connections that we have through food. And that sounds like that's pretty important to you.
If language is culture, then food is a close cousin. We are so connected to food. Just think about yourself and one of your favorite foods. What kind of memories does it bring up going way back to your childhood? And that's the power of food. Just one thing can do that.
Yeah. Well, this has been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Enrique Salmon, a professor of American Indian Studies at California State University, East Bay, and the author of Eating the Landscape. This interview is part of our podcast series on kinship with the more than human world, which is produced by, to the best of our knowledge, in partnership with the Center for Humans and Nature and with support from the Calliopeia Foundation. Our sound designer is Sarah Hopeful, and I'm Steve Paulson. If you want to find more in our kinship series, go to ttbook.org/kinship. Where you will see all our podcast episodes and a whole bunch of great essays. Thanks for joining us.